Welcome to the Climb Podcast with me, Stuart Webber. In this podcast series, we'll be interviewing guests from all walks of life, some famous, some talented, and some just with amazing stories. But what links them is they've all overcome huge challenges and adversity in their personal lives. This podcast will run alongside my greatest challenge, climbing Mount Everest, all in aid of raising funds for the Summit Foundation with an aim to help those who need a helping hand with their own life challenges. Joining me on all of these podcasts will be my friend Jonathan, who is also a trustee of the Summit Foundation. Jonathan's background is in TV, so a completely different field to me. Welcome to the Climb Podcast. Today's guest is Sir Andrew Strauss, former England cricket player, captain, and now interim director of cricket for England. We've not had a sir before, have we?
No, first one.
Welcome.
I actually wanted to start and ask you about that. How did you find out something like that?
Well, it was a very strange story, actually, because I was in my car and I got a telephone call from an unknown number. And I very rarely answer that. I'm not be answering the phone anyway, but because I was bored and it was a long journey home, I answered it and it was Theresa May on the phone.
Okay.
Who said, you know, effectively it was her resignation honours. And so as part of that, she said, would you be willing to accept a knighthood? Which I don't think you say no to that, do you? So
how'd she get your number? That's what.
Well, I don't know, but it was a very. I was like, is someone taking the piss here? That seems ridiculous.
I'd have to wonder that.
Amazing call, though.
Yeah. Well, so look, obviously, you know, it was a great honour, and the day itself, going to the palace, and you know, getting my boys suited and booted and on their best behaviour, and I think when you are lucky enough to go to those ceremonies, you find yourself surrounded by just some incredible people that really contributed in so many different ways to this country, and you kind of feel very kind of humbled to be in that company. So really special event in my life.
Do they just tell you a time, get to Buckingham Palace?
Yeah, you get your little car park ticket and whatever to go in the entrance and into the quadrangle there. And my kids and my parents came along, and the event itself lasts about an hour, so you know, there are quite a few people that are recognized, either knighthoods or OBEs or MBEs or whatever. You mingle with a lot of the other people and have a chat and whatever. And I think for everyone, the great thing about it is for everyone, it's one of the great days in their life, isn't it? So that,
yeah, I'm sure
that atmosphere and the emotion of it all is fantastic. And I think for me and my boys, just speaking openly, it was a very emotional day. Like, it was a real shame that my wife wasn't there to be a part of it, because she'd been such an instrumental kind of influence on me and everything I've done. But, you know, it was one of those days you knew that she'd be looking down and she'd be very proud of me and the boys for playing their part as well.
Yeah, I was thinking it must be a day of reflection, not only on Ruth, but also everything. Like, your parents were there, as you said, your boys.
Yeah, look, I mean, none of us really spend a lot of time in our lives. Well, I certainly don't, looking back at kind of what I've done and whatever, because you're always looking at the next thing, aren't you? And so just to have that moment to take a step back and go, wow, actually, you know, I'm very lucky to have been part of some of English cricket's great moments, and someone thinks that that's worthy of recognition like that. That's an amazing thing and very humbling. And I think also anyone who's involved in high-performance sport knows there's a lot of sacrifice, and the family is usually the body that has to do the sacrificing, doesn't it? And so, you know, all those weeks and months that I was away from Ruth and the kids, well, at least it kind of felt like it was for a purpose and for a reason.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you touched on Ruth there, so I think it'd be poignant to talk about her. You know, what happened was, you know, was tragic, and I think everyone's fully aware of what happened. But A, how did you deal with it when the reality came of, you know, you got told by the doctors, you and Ruth, that, okay, there's an end date here. And then secondly, I imagine you almost have to take up the role of mum and dad. Because suddenly, you know, when anyone who has kids knows that generally it's a partnership. There's the mum side, who she has to do what women are naturally good at. And I think us as blokes do what we are naturally good at. I think that's
not very much.
Which is drop them off at football once a week. Because what I can't understand is, and I'm hoping I never have to, if I'm honest, and I'm sorry to say that, but is how do you almost get your head around that?
Well, you don't. I think to begin with, there's just complete shock. And you're stunned and you don't know how to process it. You know, Ruth went from being exceedingly well. Like, you know, she was doing a sort of physical training course at the time. to having a few aches and pains and not feeling great to suddenly in a really, really bad state. And, you know, doctors scrambling around to realise what was going on. And then diagnosis came that she's got cancer and it's spread throughout her body. We don't know what type of cancer it is. And then comes through that she had lung cancer, which, you know, and she's never smoked a cigarette in her life. So you just, from nowhere, you're kind of like, wow. There is no right way to do it or anything. But I think as a family, you gradually get your head around what your new reality looks like. It's like a start of a new life. And for us during that period, it was about me stepping back from my focus on cricket and going, actually, the family is the most important thing. I really need to be there for Ruth as she goes through this journey and for the boys. And just taking it one day at a time. You know, your partner's being treated for cancer. You know it's a good day and then it's a bad day and you live from scan to scan. But of course, in the back of our minds, we knew pretty much right from the start, because she was diagnosed with stage four, that there was an end point to this. I think that's where she was incredibly brave and courageous, because I think my instinct was kind of like, well, let's not address the elephant in the room. Let's just kind of, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Whereas, you know, she said, look, Andy, I cannot relax and enjoy the rest of my time on this planet if I'm not certain that you and the boys are prepared for what's to come. And so that led us to going and seeing a grief and loss counsellor, and Ruth and I getting our head around the whole thing and then, you know, sharing some information with the boys at the right time, so that she knew that we had a support network there for us. You know, we were going to be okay. And that was the first thing that Jenny, this incredible counsellor that we saw, said is, you know, she said, listen, Ruth, I just want to make you completely aware that your boys are going to miss you like crazy. Like, this is going to be a very, very tough thing for them to deal with, but they will be okay. And for her and I to hear that was just the relief. Like, you know, because you automatically assume that, you know, no one's going to come back from that, like losing a parent or whatever. Yeah. And so that was a relief for her and me. And then obviously when that awful day came and the boys and I sort of started contending with our new reality, it was challenging for me. I mean, we had a good support in place from family and friends, but I just felt that incredible responsibility that I've got to look after the boys. And by the way, the boys are going to look after me. And we had that sort of very tight unit, the three of us. And, you know, gradually you find your new path, whatever that might be. So it's been incredibly challenging. And of course we miss Ruth every day, but, you know, I think I've got a slightly different mindset about life now, which is, it's, you know, it is there to be lived and enjoyed. And, you know, maybe it's a bit more about feeling fulfilled than just achieving great things. That was my life up to that point. Yeah. And the mark you leave with your kids is probably the only thing that really matters.
And I suppose in terms of Ruth's legacy, you know, the Ruth Strauss Foundation is, you know, something which is going to be there forever. You know, obviously now in cricket, you know, about with Glenn McGrath's wife, which was sad as well. There was a day for her, and they've replicated that with England, haven't they? That each day in the summer is the Ruth Strauss Foundation Day. So everyone wears red. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. So yeah, day two, the Lord's Test match, and yeah, I mean, we've done three of them now, and each one's got progressively bigger, and hopefully, it's something that really sticks for the long term, and helps the foundation in its two aims, which is to help families prepare for the death of a parent, and to fund awareness and research into non-smoking lung cancers. So, like, I mean, that's a great legacy for Ruth, and I'm very proud that we've been able to set it up. But there's a lot of people that need our help, so we're only at the start of that journey, really.
Did ECB approach you about supporting that?
No. I mean, we sort of set up the foundation probably 3 months after Ruth died, and I suppose one of the first things we thought about is if we are setting up a foundation, how do we raise money? And obviously, we did take that McGrath Foundation Day in Sydney as a template and spoke to the ECB and Lords, and, you know, everyone was just unbelievably keen to help us, which they didn't have to be. Yeah. And it's actually very hard for them to do it. Like, that was lastminute.com. So, but we've got it established now, and, you know, we're helping more and more families, and that's very heartwarming, because I know what those families are going through and how isolating it can feel for them.
It's a great example of what sport can do again, isn't it, in terms of raising awareness. You know, people often talk, unfortunately, about the bad side of sport, but the good side is it's got an unbelievable reach, isn't it? And I find in my industry, football, when things happen, people come together and rivalry goes out the window for a minute and people go, no, we want to help you. Let's help you. And I think it's another great example.
Yeah, and that is so true, isn't it? Like, you know what it's like when you're working in sport. You can kind of, you can get frustrated because it's hard to get things done and everyone's got different opinions and, you know, it's all very emotional because we're living in a sporting world. But actually, there's a sort of a family, a fraternity there that when the going gets tough, people will go out their way to help you out. Sometimes we forget that a bit, actually.
Yeah, we do, yeah.
So, we're very indebted to the game of cricket, full stop, actually, for helping us.
Just going back on what you were saying about counselling and thinking about people maybe listening to this who are going through a similar thing.
Certainly, you know, people are going through what I've just described there. Feel free to contact the Rhys Strauss Foundation, our website, and we've got counsellors that are working for us. But traditionally in this country, we haven't been good at this stuff, like that whole kind of stiff upper lip, just get on with it type thing. And actually, if you broaden it out around mental health and depression and all that sort of stuff, traditionally, we haven't been good at it. The number of people that have contacted me who've gone, you know, they might be in their 50s or 60s now going, you know what, my dad and mum died when I was 13. And from the moment they died, our family never spoke about it ever again. And the problem is you just bottle up so much stuff if you have that approach. So I think we're becoming more open as a society, which is a good thing. But we should just encourage people, A, to seek out professional help, but also just don't be afraid to go there with them and say, look, you know, how are you getting on? Like, seriously, I know you're going to say you're fine, but just talk to me.
As two guys that work in sport, do you feel that that's changed over recent years, the whole mental health awareness aspect?
Well, I'd be interested to see what you say, Stuart. I mean, in cricket, it's been a big thing recently. You know, we had some high-profile examples, Jonathan Trott, Marcus Trescothick, who were struggling with depression and anxiety, and them coming out really helped us have that conversation. The truth is, top-level sport is a brutal world, right? And it is dog-eat-dog, and everyone is pushing every button they can to get maximum performance. And so that is a very stressful, difficult environment. And I think, I don't know if football's the same, but people pretend to be invulnerable a lot of the time, whereas behind closed doors, they're really struggling. And so, you know, I think if you're really trying to have a good culture and environment, what you're trying to open up to for people to say that it is safe to say how you're feeling, and then have the right support in place so that they never get to the end of the barrel. Like, you know, and I think if you get to the end of the barrel, then it's a really hard place for anyone to be if they're breaking down and, you know, having to kind of step away from sport. You don't want them to get to that point, really. Would that be the same in football?
Yeah, definitely. I think the last few years within my world, football, there's more and more players that will come and see me and will genuinely open up now and talk about how they're feeling. And that wouldn't have happened even 5 years ago. You know, just they just wouldn't have come because it would have been that, you know, man up type of attitude and I can't show weakness. It's still a problem, but we're making steps. And what we're trying to do, I think I talk probably for football as a whole, is create more examples where people have opened up and celebrate that as opposed to almost letting it go under the carpet. It's like, no, people need to talk about this stuff. People need to show vulnerability. Definitely football has been such a worried environment about, yeah, but if I say that, I might get left out of the team because you might give the coach or manager or whatever an excuse to think that, oh, he's not mentally right. I knew he wasn't. Let me pull him out of the team. Whereas I think our leaders are getting better and better at being aware of that. And, you know, we've had, in the last 2 years, three or four incidents with players, you know, where they've come and been willing to really share that vulnerability. And I know if you spoke to any of them, they would come out and say everyone couldn't have been any more supportive and, you know, we've helped them through that. And I think the more success stories we have like that, the better because, you know, as Andy says, the elite sport is so hard because if you take, you know, we're Premier League footballers, if you look at them, it's only 11 can play in a team, you know, in the best league in the world, of which everyone wants to play in. You lose, you're vulnerable, you can lose your place, you might not get back in the team, which might mean you get sold to another club, which maybe means your earning goes down, which maybe means your popularity goes down. And I think also as well, certainly in football, which is probably a bit different to cricket, it'd be interesting to get Andy's thoughts on this, but in football as well, a lot of our players, or the large majority, are from tough backgrounds in terms of broken families, pretty much poverty, some of our players, of where they've sort of dragged themselves up from. So they haven't necessarily got brilliant support around them. And we see more and more examples of that where we have to be very honest and at times brutally honest about, you know, that family member, they might not be the best person for you, yeah. You know, and that's a tough thing to say to someone when you're potentially talking about their dad or their mum or their brother, and you're the first person in their life who's actually said that to them, of your dad's a problem for you and your career. And, it, you know, that's not an easy thing to hear. And that's tough because, you know, we've got, you know, these players now from the age of 13, 14, same players, they're kids, but players have got agents, people around, and they see them as money. You know, they literally see them as, this could be the difference sometimes for the family on moving from a one-bedroom flat where three kids are having to share a bed to living in a mansion. You know, we're talking millions of pounds here if they get it right. So, you know, we have seminars, for example, with our academy players and the parents, you know, where we will get our players who have been through challenges, who are comfortable, to talk about a dodgy agent, talk about maybe a dodgy parent, you know, and then they can talk about the figures. And sometimes it'll be stark of, I lost £1 million because of that. And it's like, oh, wow. Okay, and because we've got to make it real for people. It's because what we also have to be the fine line is understanding how tough elite sport is. So we can't also sugarcoat it either. Such tough lines. I don't know how it is in cricket, because obviously in cricket, maybe I'm going to be wrong what I say now, but I always get the impression you're a slightly more educated bunch than maybe some of our guys.
In some cases, I suppose. I think what you've just described there is the massive challenge in high-performance sport now, because ultimately we're in the winning business, right? It's high-performance sport. If you don't win, then people get sacked.
Yep.
You know, and whether we can sugarcoat that as much as we like, it's true.
Yep.
On the other hand, we have to look after people's mental health and understand that the sacrifices they make come with consequences sometimes. And so what you're trying to do is put together an environment that both challenges people and supports them at the same time. Mm. Like, too much of one without the other is a nightmare. Too much support without winning, everyone gets sacked. Too much focus on winning without support, you know, ultimately you're not doing your duty of care to the players that are playing for you. So I think a new way of managing and leading is becoming sort of more prominent. And it is one where you're there to support them. You're open to have those sort of conversations about, you know, what's really going on in your life. But at the same time, you're also being prepared to sometimes say to them, hold on, you need to step up and focus in here. And you're not doing this well enough at the moment. That's the ultimate challenge, and one that we're all trying to work our way through.
People have to understand in elite sport consequence. So, for example, if in cricket or in football, the coaches go in, okay, the game plan is this. If we do this, we believe it will give us the best chance of winning the game. And then you're not doing that and we lose a game, there's a consequence for that, because you've chose to do your own thing. And there has to be consequence for that, because as Andy says, people lose their jobs. You lose your place in the team. You can't sugarcoat that up. Mm. People get sacked. And I remember, you know, when I was a young guy at Wrexham many years ago, a guy called Joey Jones, who won 2 European Cups for Liverpool, and he was a coach at the club. And he was definitely the toughest man I've ever met in terms of his mentality. And he used to say something to the players all the time. He goes, guys, get your head around it. It's like a watered-down version of the army, elite sport. And he's right. And it's like in the army. You know, we've done a bit with the military at Norwich where, you know, people come in and speak. If you get that wrong, you die, or someone dies. It might not be you. It might be the consequences your mate dies. Mm. So there comes a time where you can't actually pussyfoot around the situation. It's, no, we do this or else someone's getting killed in their world. In ours, guys, we do this or we're losing a game or someone's getting sacked, and there is consequence with it. I think where we're certainly trying to develop in football, trying to get players to take more ownership. You know, it's something that we're trying to take a bit from rugby, which has been very good or much more advanced than us in terms of player ownership. It can't become so free and loose that everyone, because I think everyone in life needs discipline and direction.
Yeah.
You do, or else we'd just become a rudderless ship of a world. And I think you see examples of that without getting into politics, where it has become at times rudderless, and you're like, someone's got to take charge at some point. You know, I say all the time at our work, you know, Delia, our owner, and her husband, Michael, they're big on collaborative leadership. And I agree with that. I agree that, you know, it should be more diversity in thoughts and ideas. 100%, not a problem. But at the end, someone's got to make a call, and someone's got to go, right, well, brilliant, we've got all that, but we need to do this.
But I think the other point to make on this, just briefly, is that while high-performance sport is a very challenging environment, and as we said, like, if you lose consistently, people get sacked, the opposite is also true. Like, you're living the dream, you've got the opportunity to do some very special things together as a group of players and staff. And I think if you can get people connected into, like, let's go on this journey, I hate that phrase, but let's do this together as a group of people, let's do something special. And yes, get yourself emotionally connected with that, and therefore those sacrifices you might need to make, you want to do them. They're not being put on you. You know, if you can get into that sort of environment where you're looking at the upside of all of this rather than just what might go wrong, and trusting players to play their part in it and saying, like, you need to make some decisions yourself, I think that's your best chance of success. But let's be honest, high-level sport, it's very tough to ensure and guarantee success. It doesn't matter who you are, because there's so much out of your control. You can't control what the opposition are doing, and you have injuries and all these sort of things that come your way. So nothing is guaranteed. All you can do is try and shift the odds slightly in your favour.
With you two as leaders in your respective jobs, how does that work with you showing weakness and vulnerability?
I think it comes back to people you trust. Be honest with yourself first and foremost, or else if you're kidding yourself, then you've got, in my opinion, no chance then, really. I have two sets of people. So I have people close to me from a family stroke friend point of view, but they might have no level of understanding for the exact situation. And then I have people within either the industry or a similar industry who will have a level of empathy and can give me some help. I'm very, very comfortable at showing vulnerability in a group,
Okay. Individually,
and even publicly. So when we got relegated 2 years ago, I was very, very comfortable with coming out publicly in the national media and taking responsibility, talking about how I felt about it, talking about being scared, et cetera, because I was like, well, if I want my guys to be able to show that, and the only way we're going to get better is by admitting that maybe we need a bit of help and we need to improve, I've got to go and show it. And I'm fortunate that I don't find that hard. I actually find it very easy to talk to people how I feel.
The number one thing you need to do in a leadership position, in my opinion, is be able to admit when you're wrong.
If you're expecting it from other people, you have to show it first and foremost.
That's... Yeah, I think it comes about a simple saying, like, don't ask someone to do something that you're not willing to do yourself.
When you're running a team, you're effectively sacking and rehiring people every weekend who's going to be playing in the first 11. So you've got to give them clean feedback as to why they're not playing, where they need to get better, and then really good feedback when they're doing well as also. And I think when you go into the corporate world, it's much murkier, isn't it? And people don't tend to have those conversations until you get right to the end of the process where someone's already decided they need to get rid of someone or whatever. So that clean feedback, people understanding where they stand, is really important. Even if they don't like the message, at least they know what's going on.
So Andrew, just want to move the conversation on a little bit. So obviously most of our listeners will know that, you know, in your playing days, you know, opening batsman, 100 tests for England, and it always fascinates me, you're facing the ball when it's at its hardest and freshest, bowlers when they're at their freshest. You stood there, 11 people at one bowler against you, 10 of his teammates, just all trying to get you out. Often at poignant times of games, i.e. might be the start, first day. How did you develop your composure?
Yeah, well, first thing to say is I think you described it very well, which is why I always thought that opening batsmen should get paid more than anyone else in the
like
team.
Strikers.
That never seemed to go down well with the sort of middle-order players that were the glory hunters. But So, of course, like cricket, you do have to be able to concentrate for long periods of time, but you are switching on and off. You know, you actually only have to concentrate for that 2 seconds when the bowler's about to deliver the ball until the keeper hopefully catches it or you've hit it, and then you can switch off again between balls. But of course, there is a lot of time for your brain to wander and be distracted, and for the pressure of the situation or your own form or anything like that to get into your head. And so what I found actually over my career, what I got better with, and this was a lot of because of the work I did off the pitch, was just quietening the mind for the moment the ball was delivered. And so, you know, I did a lot of meditation and mindfulness and things like that, and breathing exercises as a matter of course, so that when I was in that highly charged, stressful, emotional moment, that I was able to go, okay, if I just do this, then I'm quietening my mind down. I think where it becomes very difficult is when you're fighting against yourself more than the opposition. And that happens a lot.
Yeah.
In cricket, that happens a huge amount. If you're out of form, or if you've got a bowler that's got you out a few times previously, you've half talked yourself out of it before you actually walk out there. And I think that's the last frontier for sport. I don't think we've done psychology particularly well up till now. I think we still see it as like the head doctor that you go to when things have gone horribly pear-shaped for you. And I think if we sort of, we look at mental skills in the same way as we look at technical skills or whatever, I think they're huge gains that we can make. But you need to prioritise it as such. And I don't think we do that very well in all sport at this stage.
No, we still seem to resort to it when it goes wrong.
Yeah.
It's like a last resort rather than, well, why don't we use it at the start? And there's a great guy, Damien Hughes, who I know well as a psychologist, and he always says success leaves clues. And I think it's something I always talk about with our guys of, no, when we were good, why were we good? Because there's always clues that are left there. So I'm sure when you were batting well, you would have felt a certain way all the time. You would have approached the ball, maybe approached practice, maybe even approached your personal life, how you sleep a certain way. And it's like, well, yeah, when I'm doing well, it goes like this.
I think that's right. And just like, you know, when your technique's working well, you've got something to fall back on. It's the same thing. Like, how do I get in the right mindset for me to go out and perform?
Yeah. No, absolutely. You have to ignore the noise. You have to, but like you said before, it's getting harder and harder. I'm not on social media. I've got zero interest in it. But even things filter through to me. Our chef at the club said something to me the other day. He goes, oh, did you see this? I'm like, well, I'm not on it. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, this guy was criticising you.
Oh,
morning.
Great.
You know, but like,
can I have an omelette, please?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I was like, yeah, I'll have an omelette. Yeah, thanks. But it was like, wow. And he wasn't saying it to be nasty. He's telling me because he thought I should know.
Yeah.
So even there, where it's a world where no interest in it, there's always someone who's telling you. And I think these young guys now, the players, their friends, their family, who are all on it, I don't think can help themselves but say, because they're only trying to care for their mate. I've seen this is terrible, you should reply to this. Or, and you see it eating people up. And it's, you know, we talk as older adults where we can see it as a game. That's probably a 13-year-old who supports the other team. Don't worry about it, mate. You know, they're not going to come up to you in the street and say anything. You know,
it's hard. It must be hard. I mean, I've obviously never played elite sport, so I can't imagine the pressures and how hard that must be. But yeah.
And I think that's what people don't realise, you know, when they see players go out there on a Saturday and have a bad game or whatever, they've got no idea what's going on behind the scenes and how hard it is. You know, when I'm talking about getting yourself in the right frame of mind to play your best, that's easier said than done.
And in sport as well, someone has to lose.
Yeah.
Someone has to win. That's why we tune in, right? So as sports fans, it's like, it's a sport and it's entertainment and it's, you can't always win. You won't always lose. You know, you're never as good as what you maybe think you are, and you're definitely never as bad as what you think you are. It's often somewhere in between. And probably, you know, just before we finish off, I'd like to ask you around, obviously the 2005 Ashes win was, I felt, the first time that it made cricketers almost become superstars. It almost gone from a sport which was loved by many, but
it went way beyond it, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it went mental, didn't it? In the 2005, you know, and you all became, let's be honest, overnight celebrities.
Only time in my life that I got on the VIP list for a swanky nightclub, so I was pretty happy with that.
But how did you deal with that? Because obviously, let's say in football, you're pretty much brought up as, even as a 16-year-old, you're trying to get into a nightclub and it's, oh, he plays for X club, and oh yeah, let him in. And you're almost treated as a superstar, even when you're rubbish and not anywhere near good enough to play for the first team. But how did you deal with that? And how did you not let it almost overtake your ego and start to believe in the hype a little bit?
Well, I think, quite frankly, collectively, we were useless at it. You know, I think it went completely to our heads. You know, and by the way, like, you know, open top bus parade around Trafalgar Square and there are hundreds of thousands of people cheering your name or whatever. And we felt like we'd done something really significant in the history of English cricket. And then 3 weeks later, we're on a plane to Pakistan. Like, and everyone's still in that headspace of we're these legends, you know, you know, we got whacked 3-0 by Pakistan. So, you know, I think that if ever there was a comeback down to earth, that was it. And I think, you know, what you realise is there's not a moment to lift your foot off the accelerator in sport until you hang up your boots. Yeah. Like, you've got to keep pushing forward. And, I mean, we noticed it. The team I captained, the England team I captained, we got to number one in the world. Again, like, that felt like we just got to the top of Everest. It was something we've been focused on for the entire time I played cricket for England. We got to the top. And guess what? When you're on the top, everyone's looking at you going, we want to knock them off the top. And so at the time where you feel like, oh, we've earned our moment to sort of pat ourselves on the back and relax a bit, is the moment you're at your most vulnerable. The point being that once you have retired and you've finished, you can look back on those moments and go, wow, I can't believe I was involved in that. That was a great moment in English cricket. But at the time, you can't savour it, unfortunately.
Yeah. I'll tell you what as well, just to finish up. Along the way, it must be the same for you. You meet some unbelievable people.
I bet.
And then what you also have as well, you have a camaraderie which sticks forever. So I can bump into David Wagner now, who, you know, we got promoted at Huddersfield together. And we don't talk every day. We don't need to. But when we do meet, you know, and you hug, it's like you're meeting your brother and, you know, that love that is there. And it's incredible. And even the panto of it, you have to enjoy that side of it. You have to be smart enough to take it for what it is, to know that fans are fans. You know, I was at a football game yesterday with my son, who's 5 and a half, and this bloke behind me all game couldn't stop shouting, shoot. Very educated. And then my lad shouted shoot when a player had the ball 35 yards from goal, and I've gone, whoa, no, stop it. I said, you've got to understand football, mate. You can't score from there. You've got to, you know, but you have to understand that this guy behind, he's had probably 10 beers, and he genuinely just thinks, just shoot. You know, just shoot. He genuinely, bless him, couldn't get his head around. Why aren't they shooting? He's like, mate, they're 35 yards from goal. The keeper in goal is world class. So it's not like, you know, he's going to let it in from 35 yards, unless it's a strike of all strikes. And you have to laugh. And I sort of sat there giggling in my chair, my little woolly hat on, going, this is brilliant. And that's why we love sport, right?
I'd only had 8 pints. And I do think he should have shot.
He should have shot. Well, Andrew, or Sir Andrew, sorry. Again, thank you for being so open. I think the conversation went in, you know, so many different directions. We did warn you it'd end up being just a chat with three blokes, but we really appreciate you giving your time to come on and to support us. I'd like to give a shout out to the Ruth Strauss Foundation again. And good luck as you head off into the West Indies in your new interim role.
No, it's been a real pleasure. I mean, just great chat, isn't it? Like, we could stay here all day chatting about this stuff, couldn't we?
We could.
But yeah, real pleasure to be here, and best of luck yourself.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about the Charity Foundation, please visit www.thesummitfoundation.co.uk.
To get updates on the progress of the Foundation and to follow Stuart's journey, please follow us at the Summit _Foundation. Foundation is FDN.